Ours was one of them. Another one next door was occupied by the Kultusgemeinde. The one adjacent to it housed several families. The other houses behind these were grouped around a cobbled courtyard. Wooden porches ran clear around the courtyard, connecting all the houses on both floors. To me, those porches were somehow symbolic of the way our lives were linked, and I felt safer in the knowledge that we were not alone. All the Jews now remaining in Bielitz lived in those few houses and in a huge, armory-like building with primitive plumbing, 10 minutes' walk from the Kultusgemeinde. There were about 250 Jewish people left in Bielitz, most of them old and sick. None of our once numerous kin were in this group, and there were few of our old friends, just a handful of trusting, lonely people who either could not or would not leave Bielitz. As the days went by and we settled into monotonous routine, we relied more and more on the news and rumors we heard at the Kultusgemeinde. More and more frequently, the dreaded word Aussiedlung, deportation, crept into conversations. Young people, we heard, were sent to labor camps. The old ones were sent to Auschwitz. Even then we knew what kind of camp it was. Somehow we never believed that what happened to Jews in other towns would ever happen to us. Each time, however, that I returned from the Kultusgemeinde, I would swiftly run up the steps to the apartment that we shared with the Kollanders to be reassured that Papa and Mama were still there. The Kollanders were very religious. The pious old mother alternately cried or prayed. There were also two unmarried daughters in their late 20s and a son about 45 years old. He had been paralyzed in both legs early in the war, when a tunnel under his home had been blown up. His wife and only daughter were somewhere in the part of Poland still occupied by Russia. In the adjoining apartment lived a couple by the name of Freudenreich. Mrs. Freudenreich was a frail, sweet, gentle person. Her eyes were always red. The first day I saw her and said good morning, she asked me to come in. I was struck by a large number of photographs and paintings in her room, all of a girl of about 9 or 10. Her room was like a shrine for her young daughter, who had died in an accident in Vienna a few years before. Mrs. Freudenreich talked in a monotone about her daughter and her tragic death. I said nothing. When I got up, she kissed me. "It's been so long since I kissed a child," she said. "You must come often." And I did. Downstairs lived a young woman with charming twin girls. They were 4 years old, golden blonde and blue-eyed. I loved to play with them while their mother told me about her husband, who had gone with the same transport as Arthur. She showed me some of his letters. They were full of love and anxiety to see his children. Those dreams were never to come true. In another room near ours, a middle-aged woman lived with her old mother. The mother was dying of cancer, and the daughter seemed to be losing her sanity. Her biggest concern was her inability to obtain olive oil for her complexion. When I thought of our neighbors, I sometimes had a feeling that we were the only normal family there. We got used to living in the ghetto. Ilse, Rita, and Ruth lived close by, and I saw them often. Abek came as frequently as before. We had been in the ghetto for about 2 weeks when one day, while only Papa and I were home, there was a knock at the door strong enough to break it. We knew it could only be the Gestapo. Papa hid in the wardrobe while I opened the door and faced a husky, red-faced, uniformed man with pistol in hand. "Where's your father?" he shouted at me.
"I don't know," I whispered.
"Don't you have one?" I shook my head. "What are you, a bastard?" he yelled. "All Jews are bastards. Where's your father?" he yelled again.
"I don't know." I could hardly move my lips.
"You will tell me right now, or I will shoot you like a dog."
He pointed his pistol at my heart. I felt its cold muzzle pressing my breast. When I heard Papa move in the wardrobe, I was paralyzed with horror, realizing that he might show himself in order to save me. At this moment, there was a tooting of horns and shouting outside. The intruder lowered his gun and hurried away. We learned later that the Gestapo had combed the ghetto in search of someone, and that the sound of the horn was a signal that the victim had been found. White as paper, Papa staggered out of the wardrobe. He had heard the threats, but had not known that the pistol was already touching my breast. Papa's eyes were glassy. He lay exhausted on his bed, and I brought him water. When he winced in pain and sweat broke out on his brow, I gave him one of the pills Dr. Reach had left for emergencies. "Don't tell Mama," he whispered. I shook my head. "There is only one wish," Papa continued. "One wish only. You and Arthur." He fell into a gentle sleep. I wiped the sweat from his forehead. Slowly a little color came back into his face. Then fear gripped me that my beloved Papa might die. I shut my eyes tight to avoid seeing his gray hair, his lined face, his frayed sleeves, to feel for a moment close to the happy, vital Papa of my childhood. When Papa woke, after an hour's rest, he seemed a shade paler, a shade grayer, and older. Chapter 12. A few days later, on May 8th, I woke up with Papa and Mama kissing me and saying, "Happy birthday." Mama pressed something into my hand. An orange. I hadn't seen one in almost 3 years. "Where did you get it, Mama?" But Mama would not tell. She smiled with the old merry twinkle in her sad eyes. Mama had always loved surprises. Papa and Mama wanted me to eat all of the orange, but finally they each accepted a section. Later I learned from the Collanders that Mama had given a valuable ring to obtain the one orange. It was the last birthday gift I was ever to get from my parents. Abek came and brought me a portrait of Arthur that he had painted from a photo. I was touched by the thought, and the likeness was excellent. I placed it on the table, and for a while it gave the illusion that Arthur was with us. Abek also brought roses for my birthday. Roses in the ghetto. How unreal they looked. Somehow they were not mine, but I was tremendously pleased. Ilsa, Rita, and Ruth came too. Ilsa brought me a pin, a little white dog pin. Ruth and Rita brought notepaper. Mama had made oatmeal cookies that tasted just like nut macaroons. "The rations, Mama?" I asked, but she just smiled in her old carefree way. I remember it as a very happy day, and I shall never forget it. My guests departed. I stood alone on the wooden balcony in the dusk. All of a sudden, I had an intense longing for my garden. I closed my eyes and almost felt its aroma, the cool white lilacs kissed by a May rain. I wanted to run home. I ran as fast as I could to be there in half an hour. But my garden was as remote as paradise. "I am 18 years old," I confided to the old wooden post. 18 today. Shortly after my birthday, a notice was posted that all able-bodied persons were to register for work, inasmuch as there was a critical shortage of labor. A notice followed proclaiming that those who failed to register would be sent to Auschwitz, described in the notice as a newly created concentration camp about 20 miles away. Papa, Mama, and I registered. Papa was told that he would work in Sutra, where the Germans were fortifying the river. It was a 2-hour train ride. Mama and I were to work in Wadowitz, in a shop that sewed military garments, which was about the same distance away, but in a different direction. There was a general feeling of newly found security. The wages, of course, would be ridiculously small, barely enough to cover the train fare. But we would be safe now, and might be able to stay in the Bielitz ghetto. Papa got up at 4 every morning. He had to be at work before 7. I trembled when I thought that he would have to push a wheelbarrow and work up to his knees in water. I ran home to our room every evening after work, grateful that he would be there for the all-too-short night. When Mama and I came home from work a little after 8, Papa was usually going to bed. After a week or so, Mama was not needed at the shop. For a while, they had enough help. It was good that Mama did not have to go. She could have supper ready for us and keep our room in order. I enjoyed going to the shop, even though we had to assemble and march out of the ghetto under guard and be counted like cattle at departure and arrival. The train ride was a pleasant break in the monotony. I loved seeing the forests we passed, the mountains in the distance, the meadows strewn with flowers. But best of all, I liked to open the train window and shout at the top of my voice. The clatter of the wheels would drown my voice. To shout or sing was a luxury I hadn't enjoyed in a long, long time. There always were people close by, old people, sick people. On the train, I could sing off-key to my heart's content. I missed Abeck, because I didn't see him all week, but he came as often as he could and left letters for me with Mama. Surprisingly, Papa looked better. The sun gave him a little color. I only noticed that he rubbed his arm more frequently. It bothered him, but he never complained. One gloriously beautiful Sunday early in June, Abeck came and suggested that we go for a walk. It was a wonderful and daring idea. By crossing the railroad tracks behind the ghetto, it was possible to get through the meadow into the forest. Abeck was in an unusual mood. I had never seen him quite so light-hearted. As we crossed into the forest, he tried to kiss me several times. I laughingly avoided him. This time he was not too angry with me. He took my hand and we ran down the green slope over daisies and buttercups. I could touch the grass and the flowers instead of admiring them from a distance. Running down the hill, I noticed something quite peculiar. Running alongside of me, Abeck was laughing too, but with the gaiety of a grandfather playing hide-and-seek with a grandchild. A couple of hours must have passed. It seemed a shame that this beautiful day had to end. Again we raced, this time up the hill. I got to the top first, sat down, and urged Abeck to hurry. He came up breathlessly, flung himself down at my side, and started kissing me. I was calmly observing a curiously shaped cloud in the sky. When I pointed it out, Abeck exclaimed, "Haven't you any feelings?" I was surprised, not quite knowing what he was talking about. He kissed me and asked me over and over again, "You will marry me, won't you?" But I continued to gather flowers without answering. Finally, we went home. The following Friday, we had to work longer than usual at the shop. It was quite dark as the train puffed through the sleepy landscape. We were not to work Saturday and Sunday, and the two free days stretched ahead enticingly. I was in a gay mood and gave the other girls imitations of people in the shop. I was quite good at it, and the girls roared with laughter. The train stopped at a deserted little station. As Ilse and I stood at the open window, we heard footsteps on the short platform. Then we heard voices, and we saw two young men pass by. One of them said, "Today it's Andritscha, on Monday Bielitz." Ilse and I looked at each other. Was it? I felt a little nudging pain under my heart. We did not speak for the rest of the trip. At home, Papa was still up despite the lateness of the hour. He and Mama were both waiting for me. When I finished eating my supper, Papa motioned me to sit on his bed. "What is it, Papa?" I asked, unable to bear the silence any longer. He stroked my hair but did not answer. Fear gripped me. Had they heard something, too? When Papa said nothing, I kissed him good night. He held me longer, much longer than usual. So did Mama. I lay still in my bed, but sleep would not come. I was terribly afraid, and when finally I fell asleep, I had horrible dreams. Toward morning, I woke and saw Mama and Papa packing an old knapsack. I sat up in bed, demanding an explanation. For a moment, there was silence. Then Papa sat down on my bed and told me that in the morning, Saturday, he had to go to Suche, where he worked. A camp was being formed there. On Monday, Mama and I were to be moved to Varowitz. Bielitz, our hometown, would then be Jurenrein, clear of Jews. Now I remembered what I had overheard at the little station. I wanted to shout, to cry out, to fight, but Papa's and Mama's strength kept me silent. How composed they were, packing and talking so casually. We got word that Papa and the other men were to leave on Sunday, a day later than scheduled. A strange silence fell over the ghetto. I went downstairs to play with the little twins. I could not stand seeing Papa and Mama, yet I ran back every few minutes to be with them. Abek came. He and Papa embraced. After supper, pretending to sleep, I listened to Papa and Mama talking. They talked both of the good life they had together and of what was to come, how the war would end soon, how Arthur would come back, and how he would have matured. "It is good for a man to have been away for a while," Papa commented. Presently they discussed me, how much of life I had missed because of the war. "We will make it up to her," Mama said. "She shall have the prettiest dresses, dancing, and everything a young girl should have." They talked about their parents, about the first years of their marriage, about waiting through the First World War, their reunion, when Arthur was born. Listening, I wanted to cry out, to reassure, to be reassured, but I bit my pillow in pain and kept silent. And so they talked on through the night, animated and happy. They faced what the morning would bring with the only weapon they had, their love for each other. Love is great. Love is the foundation of nobility. It conquers obstacles and is a deep well of truth and strength. After hearing my parents talk that night, I began to understand the greatness of their love. Their courage ignited within me a spark that continued to glow through the years of misery and defeat. The memory of their love, my only legacy, sustained me in happy and unhappy times in Poland, Germany, Czechoslovakia, France, Switzerland, England. It is still part of me here in America. In the morning, we did not talk about the train that was to leave a few hours hence. Silently, we sat at the table. Then Papa picked up his Bible and started to read. Mama and I just sat looking at him. Then all of a sudden, Papa looked up and asked Mama where my skiing shoes were. "Why?" I asked, baffled. "I want you to wear them tomorrow when you go to Wadowitz." "But Papa, skiing shoes in June?" He said steadily, "I want you to wear them tomorrow." "Yes, Papa, I will," I said in a small voice. I wonder why Papa insisted. How could he possibly have known? Those shoes played a vital part in saving my life. They were sturdy and strong, and when 3 years later they were taken off my frozen feet, they were good still. When it came time to leave, Papa and Mama embraced. Then Papa put his hands on my head in benediction, as he had done for Arthur. His hands trembled. He held me a while, then lifted my chin up and looked into my eyes. We were both weeping. "My child," he managed. It was a question and a promise. I understood. I threw myself wildly into his embrace, clinging to him in desperation for the last time. I gave him my most sacred vow. "Yes, Papa." We had always understood each other, but never better than in that last hour. And so we went to the station across the meadow, taking the longer way, trying to be together as long as possible. A crowd was already assembled. Papa was asked for his identification. We went out onto the platform with him. The train would leave in a few minutes. People were saying their heartbreaking goodbyes. Papa entered the last car and went to the open platform at the rear to see us as long as possible. There he stood in his good gray suit, his only one, his shoulders sloping, his hair steel gray in the sun, on his breast the yellow star and black word. There he stood, already beyond my reach, my father, the center of my life, just labeled Jew. A shrill whistle blew through the peaceful afternoon. Like a puppet, a conductor lifted a little red flag. Chug, 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 puffs of smoke rose. The train began to creep away. Papa's eyes were fixed upon us. He did not move. He did not wave. He did not call farewell. Unseen hands were moving him farther and farther away from us. We watched until the train was out of sight. I never saw my father again. Only after several moments did I become conscious of the fact that Mama was with me. She took my hand like that of a baby, and we started to walk toward the ghetto. I didn't once look at her. Only after a while did I realize that she, too, was weeping. That night she fixed me something to eat, and I ate to please her. She asked me to sleep with her in Papa's bed. I did so reluctantly. I was half asleep when I felt her arms around me, clinging to me in desperation. All my life I shall be sorry that I did not feel more tender that night. When Mama needed me most, I wanted to be alone. I pulled away like a wounded animal that wants to lick its wounds in peace. Finally, I fell asleep on a pillow soaked with my mother's tears. We rose early. While I put on my skiing boots, Mama made me a cup of cocoa, the precious cocoa which she had saved for almost 3 years for a special occasion. "Aren't you eating, Mama?" I asked. "It's Monday," she answered. Mama had fasted every Monday for half a day since Arthur had left. "But today," I said, "you should eat something." "Today especially not," she answered from the window, holding the ivory-bound prayer book she had carried as a bride. She prayed and watched me, and I watched her. The chives were uprooted on the windowsill. Yesterday we had taken out the few remaining jewels, sewed some into Papa's jacket, Mama's corset, my coat. A shrill whistle blew through the ghetto. It was time to leave. When we had made our way downstairs, we saw the woman with the lovely complexion, Miss Pilzer, screaming and begging to be allowed to go with her mother. The dying old woman was thrown on a truck meant for the aged and ill. Here the SS man kicked her, and she screamed. He kicked her again. On the same truck were Mr. Collender, the man with paralyzed legs, and the mother with her little girls. The twins were smiling. Unaware of what was happening, they were busy catching the raindrops. An epileptic woman was put on a truck. Her dog jumped after her. The SS man kicked him away, but the dog kept on trying to get in the truck. To our horror, the SS man pulled his gun and shot the dog. I looked toward Mama. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to be held by her, to be comforted. Now it was too late. Leaving the invalids behind, we assembled in a field in a suburb of Bielitz called Lachenfeld. Here we were left in the rain to wait. After about 4 hours, the SS men finally came in a shiny black car, their high boots polished to perfection. A table was set up and covered with a cloth, a tablecloth in the rain, and at that table they checked the lists of the people present. We had all assembled. Why? Why did we walk like meek sheep to the slaughterhouse? Why did we not fight back? What did we to lose? Nothing but our lives. Why did we not run away and hide? We might have had a chance to survive. Why did we walk deliberately and obediently into their clutches? I know why. Because we had faith in humanity. Because we did not really think that human beings were capable of committing such crimes. It cleared up, and then it rained again. I was tired and hungry, hot and cold, and still we stood at attention, losing track of time. Finally, certain trucks were loaded and driven off amid crying and screaming. Mama kept looking into my eyes. Her courage gave me strength. Those of us who remained were lined up in rows of four and ordered to march to the station. Instead of marching us across the meadow directly to the station, we were marched all around town. "Oh, God," I asked. I prayed, "Oh, God, are they going to do to us what they did to Erica's mother? Will we dig our own grave? Oh, God, no, 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 don't let it happen. Don't. I am afraid. I don't want to die. Don't hurt Mama. Don't." I saw Bielitz, my dear childhood town, here and there from behind a curtain. A familiar face looked out. We kept on marching. People went marketing. Guards beat stragglers with rubber truncheons. "Oh, God," I prayed, "don't let it happen." Someone pushed a baby carriage. Workmen were repairing a street. On the butcher shop, they were painting a new sign. We were marching. A dry goods store was decorating its show window. We had bought the flowered fabric for my dress there, but it was not color fast. Oh, God, don't let it happen. Don't, I prayed. Don't. At the movie theater, they were putting up a sign announcing a new feature, and we were marching. I noticed Mama grow pale. She was gripping her suitcase tightly. I jerked it out of her hand. You hurt my hand, she said in a whisper. Finally, we approached the railroad station on the opposite side of town. Beyond the station were open meadows where the annual circus set up its tents. There we waited again. From mouth to mouth, the news traveled.
Merin.
Merin was here. The King of the Jews, as he was called, had arrived. His headquarters had been at Sosnovitz, where they were the biggest Jewish congregation, the largest factories and shops in which Jews worked. Customarily, the Nazis established someone such as Merin as head of Jewish communities and gave him the job of liquidating them. It was said that Merin lived in luxury, that he had visited Goebbels, and that he was the only Jew to own a car, that he was incredibly wealthy. I imagine these things were true. Certainly he was a master of life and death. I looked at him now. He was short, perhaps a bit over 5 feet, pale and thin. He had watery eyes, dull brown hair, and he was clad in a brown raincoat. He talked in a hoarse whisper. He pulled a bottle of schnapps from his pocket, drank first, and then handed it to the SS men about him. They drank after him. I saw it all and marveled. Yes, he was all right for them. He was their kind. I'm glad you took the suitcase, Mama said very quietly. We were no longer standing at attention. I would have fainted, she continued. Why didn't you throw it away? Her voice was without tone as she answered, Arthur's picture is in it. Merin was walking in our direction. Mama prompted me, Go ask him if we are going to Wadowitz. I asked him in Polish. It was known that his German was very poor. He looked at me, his eyes without expression.
Are you crazy? Was his hoarse reply.
Mama asked me what he had said, but I had no time to answer. For all march down this way, came the command. In our clenched fists, we held our working cards from the shop, those sacred cards that we thought meant security. As we marched along in pairs, we heard cries and screams ahead of us. Mama and I held hands tightly. A cane hit our hands. They unclasped. The cane pointed at me. A voice shouted, How old? My answer came, 18. The cane shoved me aside. Like a puppet, I went. I knew Mama was marching on in the opposite direction. I did not turn around. I could not. I knew she was looking at me as Papa had looked at us from the platform of the train. I knew that if I turned around, we would have to run to each other, and that they would beat us or shoot us. We had to go on alone. I was herded toward a group where my friends Ilse, Rita, and Ruth stood. Our parents were led to the other side of the meadow, where a barbed wire enclosure had been set up. I did not see Mama, but we saw how earrings were torn out of ears, rings from fingers, and all thrown into a pail. I pictured Mama's wide wedding band with Papa's inscription in it among them, and I pictured the SS men digging greedily into the gold, digging into people's love and pledges. I saw a couple we knew. With their baby in their arms, they walked up to the SS man, the judge of life and death. He told them to give the baby to those marching to the right and motioned them to the group to the left. I saw the couple look at each other. Then I turned away, feeling the wide field revolving around me. When I looked again, sick and limp, I saw the couple embracing their baby and walking slowly toward the right. We had assumed all along that we were going on a train, but now a truck came for us. I was the last one to enter it. Then I screamed, I want to go with my mother, and jumped down. Just then Merin passed. He looked at me, and with strength unsuspected in that little man, he picked me up and threw me back on the truck. You are too young to die, he said tonelessly. I glared at him. I hate you. I screamed. I hate you. His eyes were without expression. There was a faint smile on his pale, thin lips. It would have been easy for him to order me down and send me with my mother. Why did he not? Strange that the man who sent my mother to death had pushed me into the arms of life. Someone fastened the canvas across the back of the truck and Marin walked away. Then, above all the screams coming from behind the barbed wire, I heard my mother. "Where to?" she called. I spread my arms and leaned out of the truck. I did not know the answer. "Mama! Mama!" I called, as if the word could convey all I felt. Above all the confused, painful cries, I heard Mama's voice again. "Be strong!" And I heard it again like an echo. "Be strong!" Those were my mother's last words to me. As the trucks pulled away, the late afternoon sun came through the gray clouds for a moment. Its rays touched the roof of the church, glistening wet. The church bells were ringing, and then the sun disappeared. Once more, Bielitz was gray and dark, and as the truck rolled on, the city disappeared before my misty eyes. Part 2. Chapter 1. The truck rolled on for perhaps an hour or two. I hardly bothered to wonder where they were taking us. My thoughts were with Papa. I feared what might happen to him when he heard about Mama. His heart would not stand the shock. Our truck and the others stopped at a little station, and we were put on a passenger train. For hours the train stood on a siding. I looked out of the window, pressing my forehead against the cool glass, and wondered where Mama might be. I prayed, lost in thought, clinging to the faint hope that she had been taken to Vodovich to work in the shop after all. As the evening shadows crept over the little station, I felt the jolt that precedes the starting of a train, and then we rolled toward our unknown destination. A vivid picture formed in my brain. Mama sitting on a crowded floor in the corner of a dirty freight car, also in motion. I could see her hands pressed together, her face white, her beautiful eyes filled with tears. I knew she would be praying with all her might, praying for Papa and her children, praying for our strength, because she herself was no longer afraid. I felt the serenity that had come over her, the strength that had emanated from her during our last hour together. And then a picture, cruel and unthinkable, started to revolve in my mind, about the torture she might have to endure, about the heat that might burn her to ashes, which would then be scattered to the winds. My beloved mother, I felt both the heat and the cold of the horror. Finally, I could suffer no longer. My eyes remained dry. I felt my features turn stony. "Now I have to live," I said to myself, "because I am alone and nothing can hurt me any more." And the picture of Papa's and Mama's mute farewells, those two faces suffering without uttering a cry, was imprinted in my heart forever. Ilse sat next to me at the window, her lips repeating, "Mama, Mama, Kitty, Kitty," tears running down her face. None of the girls spoke. Each was alone with her tragedy, suffering in her own way as the train sped on through the evening. I felt remote and alone. A piece of broken bottle was lying under a seat. I picked it up and played with it. Then I drove its sharp edge into my palm. The blood trickled onto my cuff, but the wound did not hurt. There was no pain. "It does not matter. I'm going to live. Mama and Papa are going to live. I am going to live to be with them, and if it happens to them, I'm going to live for revenge. I'm going to live." The wheels of the train, beating in rhythm, were saying over and over, "I'm going to live. I'm going to live." We passed through Katowice, and I knew that we had traveled 56 kilometers to the north of Bielitz. We were not going to Auschwitz, but where then? After another 20 kilometers, the train slowed to a stop, and we read a faintly illuminated station sign. Sosnowiec. Our guards ordered us off the train and marched us through the dark, empty streets. It occurred to me that Abek's family lived in Sosnowiec. Abek? I had not thought of him at all. He now seemed as far away as someone I had known a long time ago. I wondered fleetingly if I would be able to see his family. Finally, exhausted, we halted in front of a tall building that turned out to be the headquarters of the Militz. The Militz, an auxiliary police, was a Jewish force established by the Germans, headed by a notorious SS commander and a subordinate Jewish commander. Young Jews were conscripted to fill its ranks. We were marched inside, led through dim passages, and finally into a large hall upstairs. Everywhere Militz men were milling about, and an excited exchange of questions followed. They were curious to know where we came from, and we in turn asked anxiously where we were going. A shrug of the shoulders and probably to camp. This was our small satisfaction. "Come, lie down," Ilse whispered. She had spread her coat on the floor near a window. I lay down, but sleep would not come. After a while, I got up and started to walk about again. On a shelf, I spotted a stack of paper. I took a sheet. Under the faint light of the single bulb, hardly conscious that I had taken a pencil from my pocket, I wrote these words: "My beloved brother." Then slowly it trickled into my mind that I had to write him and tell him, and the wish that was dearest to my heart and which I could not consciously express wrote itself down in the letter. I told Arthur that Papa was in Suche and Mama in Vardovich, and that I was on my way to a camp, and that he had no cause to worry. I reminded him that our parents were young, that they would be able to stand the hardships, and that we would soon be together again at home. "Young?" "Yes, young," I answered myself. Mama was barely 45 and Papa 55. They were young people, much too young to die, but too old to bear more suffering. They had already suffered too much. "But they are young," I answered myself in defiance. "They must live," and I continued my letter to Arthur. When I had finished it, I put it in my bosom and felt comforted. There was now a link with Arthur, a link with Papa, Mama, and home. I lay down next to Ilse and instantly fell asleep. There were gray shadows in the room when I opened my eyes, and on the opposite walls the naked bulb gleamed dimly. I heard whispers around me, some stifled crying. The picture of yesterday's events came into my mind. I was in Sosnovitz. And Mama? I looked out of the window into the misty street below. In the bleak light of dawn, shadowy figures were going somewhere. Then I distinguished their yellow stars of David. I marveled at how many Jews I saw. There had been so very few in Bielitz. Snosnovitz, I had been told, had the largest Jewish community in all of Germany. There had been a large Jewish population before the war, but now all the shops and factories in which Jews worked were located here. Sosnovitz was just inside the border of the government, and many Jews had fled there in the hope of finding work and safety. I decided to try and see Abek's parents, and I asked one of the Militz men how to get permission to leave the building. "You have to go to the commander," he said. "Where is he?" "Here in the building." "When can I see him?" "Listen," the Militz man said, obviously tired of my questions and lack of comprehension. "You have to register ahead for an appointment. Do you think you can just walk in and see him?"
"I'm going to see him this morning," I said quietly, more to myself. The guard shrugged his shoulders and smiled. I walked out into the corridor. We were not restricted within the building, but I noted through a glass panel that the outside door was guarded by Militz men and one SS man. Walking along the corridor, I suddenly felt a new freedom born from the realization that, no matter what action I might take, only I would have to bear the consequences. Nothing that I might now do could harm Papa and Mama. I felt elated. A long line of fearful people with a hunted look on their faces stood in front of a door that was blocked by a guard, begging, offering money to get an appointment with the commander. I stood there hardly believing what I saw. Still, I was sure that I was going to see the commander.
I noticed a second door marked private and decided it was the one to try. I went back to our room and told Ilsa my plan.
"Please don't do it," she begged. "But Ilsa, I am not afraid," I told her. "I will be all right."
I went out into the corridor again. The air of excitement indicated that the commander had arrived. The guard was frantically driving people away from the door. Thinking fleetingly that Papa and Mama would scarcely recognize their shy little girl of yesterday, I went quietly to the door marked private, turned the knob, and entered. There, at a littered desk, sat a fat, bald man, his forehead shining, his eyes small and piercing. His fleshy lips curled in a vulgar, greedy manner toward the glass of tea he was lifting. He turned to me, startled, amused, a bit angry.
"Yes?"
What a picture I must have made in my heavy ski boots and schoolgirlish tweed suit, and with long black braids falling over my shoulders. "Are you the commander?" I asked pleasantly in German.
"I certainly am," he answered in Polish, then checked himself and repeated it in German, which I noted at once was faulty. The few words he had spoken betrayed the fact that he spoke neither language correctly. I felt that this man hated his ignorance, that my mastery of both Polish and German somewhat compensated for the power of his position. I chose my words with care and spoke slowly in German.
"I would like a permit to visit my relatives who are living here in town. Their name is Feigenblatt. Could you please give me one?" I said it without begging in my voice. He leaned back in his chair and scrutinized me, his fleshy lips twisting into a smile. I went on. "And I might as well tell you that I have neither money nor jewels to pay for it." What was dictating my words? I felt like an actress on a stage. His smile vanished. He was sitting upright now. I sensed that nobody had spoken to him like that in a long time. Apparently I had caught him off guard. He opened his mouth and closed it again.
"Can I see your Ausweis?"
"I have no identification," I answered. "Why do you have people crying outside your door? Do you like it?" "You can't like it." He stared at me. I wondered if I had gone too far. Staring right back at him, I lowered my glance to the Star of David on his chest. "Could I have the permit, please?" I repeated, my voice soft and steady now. He was still looking at me when his fingers pressed a bell. A young Militz man came in. The commander wrote something on a piece of paper.
"Your name?"
he asked, his voice gruff. Then, after a moment, he added,
"Please."
Silently, he handed me the permit. "Thank you." My voice held, although my knees felt weak and I was shaking. The commander told the guard to accompany me. Then he did me an honor that he probably accorded no one else but the SS. He got up and stood while I left the room. I was thoroughly shaken. I hardly knew myself. I had never spoken like that. I had never felt like that. I was different in a thousand ways from yesterday, but the knowledge that such strength was within me gave me the courage to go on. Chapter 2. It was a bright, warm, sunny day, and I walked along the streets of Sosnovitz, the Militz man at my side. Almost everyone I saw wore the yellow star, and this gave me a feeling of comfort. After perhaps half an hour's walk, we came to a large apartment house on which I saw an enameled sign which read Beskidenstrasse. Under it was a small number 6. I rubbed my eyes. This looked quite different from what I had imagined while writing to Abeck at this address. To me, home meant a house like ours, with a garden and flowers. I couldn't associate a large apartment building on an unshaded street with home. As we walked up the stairs, I rehearsed what I was going to say, how I would explain who I was, but before I could knock, the door was thrown open, and Abeck's dark-haired pretty sisters, Paula and Lola, rushed out to embrace me. They seemed to be expecting me. A tall, gaunt, erect woman in black came forward.
Her resemblance to Abek was striking, though her features were softer. Her face was pale, her eyes red, as though they had been crying. She embraced me without a word and slowly stroked my hair.
"My poor child," she said finally, "we are not going to let you go anywhere. You are going to stay with us."
The guard broke in immediately, pointing out that my permit expired within 2 hours. Abek's mother did not answer him. She just went on stroking my hair.
"Come, child," she said after a while. "You must eat something and get some rest."
"I am responsible for her and must be with her all the time," the Militz man insisted.
"Let her wash," Paula said firmly.
Her voice had a melodious quality. "I will stay with you as hostage if necessary." Abek's mother led me into a bedroom and hovered over me while I took off my jacket and proceeded to wash and brush my hair. When Lola came into the bedroom carrying warm food, I suddenly realized that I had not eaten since the morning before, when Mama had fixed me the precious cocoa that she had saved since before the war. Yesterday. Was it only yesterday that I was with Mama? It seemed so far away. Everything that had happened since yesterday was like a monstrous dream. While I ate, Abek's mother asked about him. She had not seen him for many months and was, of course, anxious to hear and know all about him. Although I had seen him only 2 days before, there seemed to be little that I could remember to tell her. She seemed to sense it, for soon she excused herself and left me alone. I felt very tired now. All I wanted was to sleep for a long, long time. I rested my head on my arms on the table and closed my eyes. After a bit, I heard soft steps approaching. I opened my eyes and saw Abek's picture before me. It was a warm gesture to make me feel welcome and at home. I looked at him. He seemed strange and aloof, and again I had the sensation that he was someone I had known a long time ago and half forgotten. Abek's mother was watching me. Ashamed, I lowered my eyes. Abek, it turned out, had telephoned to the Kultusgemeinde in Sosnowitz and sent a message about me to his parents. I had no doubt that to make the call he must have bribed a guard, for Jews were not allowed to use telephones. An uneasy feeling came over me that Abek had not merely asked, but ordered his family to help me. It was this thought that kept crossing my mind while Abek's mother talked of her plan to get me out of the transport. The important thing, she said, would be to secure a working card for me. That meant that I would need a certificate of employment. Paula and Lola had come up with an idea, however. They were sewing underwear for a German shop at home. A quota had to be met, of course, and twice a week they delivered the required number of garments to the factory. They hoped that in exchange for one of their machines, they would be able to obtain a working card for me. They would then take turns on the remaining machine and fill their quota by working day and night. I was taken aback by their generosity and stammered a protest at their proposed sacrifice. "Abek's happiness is at stake," his mother said simply, tears streaming down her cheeks. I took her hand and kissed it. She leaned over, embraced me, and touched my forehead with gentle lips. There was a knock at the door, and the guard entered. My time was up. Despite the sister's pleading, he remained adamant. I would have to leave before Abek's father returned from work. "Until tonight, then," Abek's mother said as the guard hurried me down the stairs. "We may have good news for you by then." When we got close to the Militz headquarters, I saw that all the girls from Bielitz were assembled outside. In the last row, I spied Ilse, frightened and on the verge of tears. When I had made my way to her, she whispered, "I thought that you wouldn't come back any more." I noted that she was the only one who stood alone. We clasped hands silently. We were marched through the streets of Sosnowitz, the sun beating down unmercifully and the asphalt feeling soft underfoot. After an hour we came to a large, unfinished red brick building, obviously meant to be a school. Work apparently had been stopped when the Germans had invaded Poland. We were led to the rear of the building, to a large yard that had been fenced in by barbed wire. Signs of construction were still in evidence. Mounds of sand, gravel, and cement were scattered about the yard as they had been left by the construction workers. Two SS men guarded the entrance and counted us as we entered. Once inside, we stood at attention. My temples throbbed after the hard march. We were in a so-called Julag, an abbreviation for Durchgangslager, or transit camp, which in this case served as a labor pool. We were to be chosen for work in the German war industry and would be trained by the people who had requisitioned us from the SS. We learned later that industrialists paid the SS 3.5 Reichsmark, approximately $1, for each worker, plus a small fraction of what constituted normal going wages, according to the services performed by their slaves. Finally, we were herded into the building and assigned to a large room upstairs. In neat rows throughout the room were crude four-tier bunks, some of which were already occupied. Ilse and I managed to find two vacant neighboring bunks on the fourth tier, just under the ceiling. The heat was most oppressive, despite the fact that we were near a barred window. There was a bit of straw scattered over the bunks, and we soon discovered that vermin nested in it. It was unbearably hot just under the ceiling. Even the wood felt hot to our touch. Still, I wore the woolen suit and ski boots that Papa had insisted on. Because I felt nauseated by the vermin and the heat, we climbed down from our bunks. As I started to tell Ilse about my visit to Abeck's family, we were ordered to assemble downstairs in the yard again, together with a group of girls from Cheshire, Czechoslovakia. When we got downstairs, we found that more groups like ours were lined up, altogether perhaps 100 girls. After what seemed like half an hour's appel, or roll call, a sleek limousine drove through the gate. Two giant SS men and one elegantly clad civilian got out. "Achtung!" thundered one SS man, and we snapped to rigid attention. The three men stood near us, talking. I could hear fragments of their conversation. One SS man said, "Billets," and pointed to our group. Then I heard the word Weberei, weaving mill. After a while, the civilian was handed a cane. Walking up and down the rows, he pointed to the girls who were to step out of line and walk over to the other side of the yard. He pointed to me. After I crossed the yard, I looked back with longing to Ilse. To my great relief, she soon joined me, and so did all the other girls from Bielitz. Altogether, 50 of us were picked for the same camp. The girls from Bielitz, the ones from Cheshire and vicinity, and a few others whom we saw for the first time in the yard. We were told to go back to the room. As we passed through the downstairs hall, we heard feeble voices calling from behind a closed door. A few of us tried the door and went in. What we saw was sickening. Several living skeletons, clad in rags that crawled with vermin, stretched out begging hands. Some had only one leg or were maimed in other ways. Their faces were drawn, their eye pits burned feverishly. They told us that they had come from camps where they had become ill or had been injured in accidents. Most of those who had lost limbs had been working in a quarry. They knew they were now going to Auschwitz to be gassed and cremated. They were no longer useful to the glorious Third Reich. They had given their strength, their youth, their health, and now they had to give their lives. They were hungry, they said. On impulse, we ran upstairs to our bunks and gave them all the bread we had. Late that afternoon, we were again called to stand appel. We formed in separate groups just as we had been picked. Some of the sick crouched near the fence. A steaming kettle of food was brought, and one by one we marched by. Each of us was handed a rusty, battered bowl filled with ill-smelling potato scraps and an unwashed, greenish vegetable. Ilse, who was ahead of me, stopped to talk to someone from Bielitz. I took my food to the end of the line near the fence, where one of the sick girls sat on the ground, scraping her empty bowl with a dirty aluminum spoon. "Do you want mine?" I asked, offering her the bowl. She looked at me stupefied, her eyes burning. Slowly she set her bowl on the ground, rose, and with both her hands gripped my empty hand,
and was about to lift it to her lips. Then she stopped, seeing my bewilderment. Her head was closely cropped. High on her cheeks were two red spots. Her body was pitifully emaciated, her neck overly long. We looked at each other. For a fleeting moment I thought she must be my age. I did not know her name or where she came from. I only knew that she was going to meet her death. She stood there against the wire fence with the light of the setting sun on her face. She looked at me, perhaps wondering about the past, and I looked at her, wondering about my future, the bowl of unsavory food between us. I closed my eyes. "God bless you, may you never know what hunger is," she said to me. When I opened my eyes, she handed me her empty bowl. I looked at her, not understanding. "Turn it in," she said. "If they find me with two bowls, I might be beaten because they will think I stole it." I still think of her, that nameless one, standing against the barbed wire fence of her blessing and her wish. Evening came, followed by a restless night. Ilsa and I could not sleep. We talked and talked. We had heard rumors about the camp we were going to. It was said to be a textile mill, a good place to work, and we would be the first Jewish girls there. We were wakened early and stood Appel in the yard. We had no idea when we would leave, and I had no way of knowing what Abek's family had accomplished in the meantime. Around noon, most of the ill were put on a truck and driven off, some crying, others in pitiful resignation. I ran up to my bunk and wished desperately that I could cry. In the afternoon, I was called before the supervisor of the Julag, a Jew, in charge under the supervision of the SS. A Militz man in his office handed me a suitcase, telling me that Abek's family had sent it. I hurried to Ilsa to open it with her. We found clothes from Lola and Paula, and at the bottom, bread. The sight of the bread made me realize how hungry I was, for I had not eaten since I had been in Abek's apartment more than 24 hours before. I broke off two pieces of bread and handed one to Ilsa. She started to devour her piece and then stopped abruptly. Taking the bread out of her mouth, she swiftly unrolled a piece of thin cardboard. Written on it was a message that I should be set free soon. My heart skipped a beat. Ilsa embraced me. "I am so happy for you," she said, and I knew that she meant it. She possessed the rare quality of never being envious. Late in the afternoon, I was summoned to the supervisor's office again. He beckoned me toward his desk. His hands were well-groomed, and his dark hair was very neat. He must have been about Papa's age, but looked much, much younger. "You are lucky," he said. "You are free to leave. A working card has been secured for you."
"But I was picked for camp," I said, nothing else coming to mind.
"You were chosen in number only. The rosters are not yet made up. We can easily substitute someone else. This is a new camp, you know. The new ones are usually better, and some other girl will be glad to go in your place. In about an hour, a guard is going to town, and you can leave with him."
"I don't know. I just don't know," I was saying, half to myself.
"What do you mean you don't know?" the supervisor asked in disbelief. "You mean you don't want to get out?"
He looked at me penetratingly.
"Well, you have the hour to think it over."
I don't know why I hesitated. Perhaps it was intuition. All of a sudden, I didn't want any special privileges. I wanted to be with the others. But I knew, too, that there was another reason. Slowly, I climbed the stairs, returned to my bunk, and sat down next to Ilsa. She had already bundled up the clothes I had received from Abek's family and was ready to say goodbye. "Ilsa," I said, "I don't think I'm going." She looked at me in bewilderment. "Are you out of your mind? You have to go. You owe it to Abek."
In all my confused thoughts, the word "oh" hammered on in my brain.
"Go, go, before it's too late," Ilsa urged me.
"Leave me alone," I barked at her. "I have an hour to think it over. Just leave me alone." The bunks between ours and the window were empty. Ilsa moved up to the window, and I saw her sitting there, her forehead pressed against the bars, her arms folded, and above her the square window, the broiling hot, gray-blue sky. I sat alone, hugging my bundle. In my mind, Ilsa's words kept spinning over and over.
oh, I felt, was the one that held me back. I knew, as I never had before, that I did not love Abek. I could love his family, but what place would I have in their house?